Hi, this is Mallory Nye, and welcome to Podcast 6. This is the Mallory Nye Writer and Academic Podcast Series. And in this episode, I'm going to be talking about some of the issues of Britishness and Scottishness that have come out of the independence referendum of September 2014, what came to be known as the Indie Ref. What does it mean to be British? Scottish independence and the Indie Ref. And why the British may one day learn to be more like the Scandinavians. I voted yes to an independent Scotland in September 2014, and I look forward to the day when it happens. Like many others in Scotland, I was very disappointed with the result. I have always struggled to have a clear idea of my national identity. You may get something of my problem just by listening to my accent. I was born in Wales. I grew up in both England and Wales, and I have spent much of my adult life in Scotland. When I lived in Wales, I felt very English. The term Sais was often used about me when I was at school. That's the Welsh word for the English, Sais. It's rarely used positively, and most often used as the phrase Jackie Sais. I was confused by that, as Jack was the name of my brother, not me. But, of course, we were both English. I have now lived so long in Scotland that England feels almost like a foreign country to me. Despite being English, I've only lived about 10 years of my life actually in England. Because of this, it has always felt convenient to think of myself as British rather than anything more specific. At the time of the Scottish independence referendum, I began to find myself with a small problem. If the majority of the people in Scotland had voted yes for independence, then I wasn't sure which passport I would choose. In an independent Scotland, I could have either kept my UK passport and so become a foreign national in the place where I live, or otherwise I could have taken a Scottish passport. Possibly, I would have been able to hold both. I didn't know which I would choose. And in the present circumstances, I don't have to now, at least not for the present. The thing is, nationality is much more than a matter of identity. Or to put this otherwise, identity is much more than a matter of nationality. Sometimes the two overlap quite easily, and we have a passport that states clearly who we think we are. For someone whose family has lived in Scotland for generations, then it may be an exciting prospect to one day have a Scottish passport, whenever they become available. Likewise, perhaps one day we will see the issuing of English, Welsh, Yorkshire, or Cornish passports, who knows? The big question was not so much about me and my passport, but rather, in a post-independence former United Kingdom, what would happen to Britishness? Would Scots fall off the edge of such a thing once they all became citizens of the independent Scottish nation? At present, in the United Kingdom, those living in Scotland, Wales, and England have Britishness as their default nationality. And for those who, like me, have lives and families that have spanned the borders of each separate country of that union, it has been a national identity, Britishness, that encompasses several aspects of their diversity. As a nationality, it is rather troublesome, not least because the sovereign nation of the United Kingdom is made up of both Great Britain and Northern Ireland. Not all UK citizens are British, not least, of course, those in the 6 counties of Northern Ireland who consider themselves Irish, over 500,000 of which. And the legal identity of being a British subject has been used historically in many different ways, including until 1949, for residents of the British Empire across the world. This identity, this status, is still in use for a very limited and dwindling number of individuals who once lived under British colonial rule. In places such as what is now the Republic of Ireland, up until 1949, the former Malayan colonies of Penang and Malacca, which are now part of Malaysia, and also Hong Kong. All this notwithstanding, the term British citizen technically refers to a citizen of the United Kingdom, that is Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales, and England. This will, of course, change if Scotland becomes independent. Citizens of Scotland will become Scottish citizens, but may still remain British citizens if the remaining UK government chooses to allow such dual citizenship with Scotland. So if Scotland does eventually become independent, and I trade in my UK passport for a Scottish one, will I stop being British? Or more broadly, will Scotland stop being British if or when it becomes independent? This is where Britishness becomes something more than about citizenship and passports. Just as it is possible to have a UK passport and be a British citizen without being British, i.e. being an Irish citizen of the UK in Northern Ireland, the identity of being British goes further than pure citizenship. The idea of Britishness has a history. It was at one point invented, as so many such terms tend to be, making use of historical, largely Greek and Roman sources, to give legitimacy and roots to the concept. Britishness and the idea of Britain has been shaped in large part by power, particularly the power of England in relation to the smaller nations of Scotland and Wales, and the forced marriages that took place over the centuries to create the entity that is now the United Kingdom. The sense of Britishness largely came into being with the Act of Union in 1707, when the separate kingdoms of England, including Wales and Scotland, became united as the Kingdom of Great Britain. It was later expanded when the further union occurred in 1800 to create the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland. And not least, the idea of Britishness emerged from defining the nation, culture, and place in a global context. The empire that was British rather than specifically English. The Britishness of the empire became the default form of identity of the political configuration that grew out of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland's global dominance in the 19th century. Britishness and the idea of Britishness has also changed and developed. While the former Education Secretary, Michael Gove, may have found it easy to talk of British values in the schools of England and Wales, the values of the 19th century under that heading were quite distinct from anything we might feel appropriate today. And whilst Britishness has always needed to encompass a diversity of peoples, for most people, UKIP and BNP supporters notwithstanding, the idea of 21st century British identity is rooted in a multicultural and religiously diverse context that has changed almost beyond recognition in the last 50 years. That change has happened. A racially homogenous British identity has long gone. Britishness is now mixed up and heterogeneous. On independence, Scotland would move out of the UK, but it would not move geographically out of the British Isles. The culture of Scotland would not change dramatically from what it was before. Scottish culture has for centuries been a distinctive and often leading and progressive branch of British culture. However we may define Scots culture, it shares much with its immediate neighbours to the south, whilst also having strong elements of difference. In short, although Scots in an independent nation may trade in their British passports for the Scottish ones, they will not lose their British culture and identities. The most useful analogy here is probably to look across the North Sea to the east, to the distinct national identities of the Scandinavians. The political histories of Denmark, Norway, and Sweden have been linked in various ways, but they have survived into present-day collective identities of difference, under the identity of being Scandinavian. This is not a national identity, and unlike Britishness, it has never been a basis for such nationality. But if the people of the various British countries, Wales, England and Scotland, can see themselves mirrored in their three near neighbours of Denmark, Norway and Sweden, then the collective identity of being British is not so different from how the people of those countries have lived with being Scandinavian, without necessarily being a single political or national entity. Like the UK, the boundaries of Scandinavia have been contested. Finland was once part of Sweden, but is not considered to be Scandinavian in the proper sense. Iceland, the Faroe Isles, and Greenland all have close cultural and historical ties with Scandinavia, but are more properly considered as part of the group of Nordic countries, rather than as Scandinavian. Scandinavia has seen a single currency and sporadic attempts at political union, but has broadly settled into three independent nations sharing a common, more regional and broadly cultural identity. For me, this answers the issue of my identity. I may eventually hold a Scottish passport, based on longevity of residence in Scotland. I may see my roots as being primarily English, since both my parents originated from the southeast of England. I also have a deep affectional relationship with Wales, where I lived for much of my childhood. And because I come from the family of nations that make up the British Isles, I have no problem with thinking of myself also as British. That doesn't need to be a national identity, but rather something that describes much more than what is printed on my passport. It will be interesting to see how well the rest of the English learn to live with the idea that Britishness is not something that comes from a political union within the British Isles, but is an identity freely chosen by its diverse people. The term Great Britain may have resonances of an enforced union, led by the dominant England as it expanded its political influence. But that does not prevent the idea of being British having a less politically charged nuance, describing a family of equals rather than serving as the template for a global empire. When that happens, it is likely that the idea of being British, in its diverse, multicultural and progressive sense, will be attractive to most of the inhabitants of this small group of islands. In September 1774, on the eve of the American Revolution, the First Continental Congress met in Philadelphia to discuss the grievances of the 13 colonies against their British rulers. This Congress would meet for a second time a few months later, and from it developed the government of the independent United States of America. One of the representatives at this initial September 1774 meeting was Joseph Galloway, a loyalist to British rule, who later fought on the British side in the War of Independence. Galloway put forward to the Congress his plan of union, which envisaged a framework for the continuance of British rule over the 13 American colonies. This would include a Grand Council or Parliament for the colonies, subject to the power of the British Parliament and Crown, in its own words, an inferior and distinct branch of the British legislature, and also a President General. In sum, Galloway's plan was largely one of unionist devolution for the American colonies remaining under British rule. In many respects, this was the Devo Max option of the American Revolution. For Galloway, the American colonies and Great Britain were better together. Galloway's plan of union was narrowly rejected by the Congress, with a difference of 5 in favour and 6 against, out of a total Congress of 56. By far the majority of the representatives at that First Continental Congress wished to address their grievances against British rule with a move to independence. Scotland, in 2014, was, of course, in a very different situation to the USA in 1774. It is notable, however, that the move to American independence was in large part fueled by the issue of taxation, which has echoes with the rise of Scottish nationalism in the 1980s under Thatcher's poll tax. Indeed, in many respects, the establishment of the Scottish Parliament in 1999 is remarkably similar to the structure outlined in Galloway's proposed plan of union to the First Congress. However, we should also remember that when the USA declared independence in 1776, the independence that the new country sought was from the United Kingdom of Great Britain, that is, a country that was made up of both England and Scotland. Indeed, as Linda Colley points out, one of the grievances of John Adams, later to succeed George Washington to become the second president of the USA, was that the two realms of England and Scotland were, by the Act of Union of 1707, incorporated into one kingdom by the name of Great Britain. But there is not one word about America in that act. So some may argue, as Richard Halloran recently did, Scotland is the last of the English colonies to leave the fold, and the vote of September 2014 could potentially have been the final end of the long decline of the British Empire. If this were ever to be the case, even if Scotland left, we must remember that the United Kingdom would still remain intact, albeit without Scotland, and the Principality of Wales would still remain in the political partnership with England, and also Northern Ireland, of course. The comparison with American independence does also draw our attention to the fact that the United Kingdom has a long history of ceding power. In fact, this has been happening for much of its history as a United Kingdom. When the Act of Union between Scotland and England came about in 1707, the new United Kingdom of Great Britain ruled over a substantial empire that included 13 American colonies. Although Georgia was not founded as a colony at that time, the colony of Carolina was divided into North and South until 1729. The loss of the American colonies was a blow to Scotland as well as to England. But history tells us that the loss of that empire was balanced very quickly by new gains for Great Britain. Indeed, the combination of Scotland and England as the United Kingdom proved a very potent force. The American colonies were no longer under their rule, but Britain's substantial global power continued, with Canadian and Caribbean colonies in full strength, together with the newly emerging Eastern Empire in Asia, particularly India. The nation's recovery in the last part of the 18th century and the subsequent development of the Second British Empire after American independence was largely due to Scotland and England working together. This came about, for example, in the income generated by Scottish and English-owned slave plantations in the Caribbean, and also the highly successful political alliance between William Pitt the Younger and the Scottish politician Henry Dundas. And it was a united British, i.e. English and Scottish army, that defeated Napoleon at Waterloo, with help from the Germans, and cemented Britain's role in the 19th century as the primary European superpower. The end of the 19th century, along with the first half of the 20th, saw this change substantially. During that time, Britain began to see the long process of colonies again move towards and achieve independence across the empire. Canada between 1867 and 1931, Australia between 1901 and 1939, New Zealand between 1907 and 1947, Ireland in 1921, India and Pakistan in 1947, Malaysia in 1957, and the African nations in the 1960s. One of the exceptions to this process was, of course, Hong Kong, which in 1997 did not take independence from Britain, but instead underwent the transfer of rule from Britain to China, under the terms of the leases signed by the two countries in the late 19th century. Great Britain has become very familiar with the process of granting independence to territories under its sovereignty. Unfortunately, however, it has been quite rare for this to occur peacefully and without conflict. The question that Scotland has now been facing is to what extent have Scotland and England been irretrievably integrated by this shared process as Great Britain? Are the two countries like a married couple, as parents of several generations of children who have all now grown up and flown the nest, USA, Canada, Australia, Ireland, India, and so on? Or is it more true to say that England has been a harsh patriarch who has sought the subjugation of all under its control, including Scotland? During the referendum debates, the Better Together campaign stressed with great clarity the benefits of the English-Scottish partnership. As before did the British Loyalists to their American subjects in the 1770s. It is true that there have been many benefits to Scotland of rule from Westminster in the past 300-plus years, not least Scotland being able to exercise international power and accumulate considerable wealth through the UK in a way that it could not have done on its own. The impact of Scottish independence might not be as significant in the long term as what happened in America in 1776. Its local impact, however, would be immense, particularly in terms of what would happen to the remainder of the United Kingdom after Scotland's departure. It is interesting even to ask whether there could be a United Kingdom of Great Britain once Scotland has left, since such an entity has only existed since 1707, including Scotland. Prior to 1707, the Union of England and Wales was known simply as the Kingdom of England, following Henry VIII's incorporation of the Welsh legal system into England in 1535. Of course, Scotland will not stop being British after independence. Being British will remain as the regional identity for the Scots, even if or when Scots cease to have a default British national citizenship. For over 300 years, Scotland has had a very significant impact on world history as a prominent partner within the United Kingdom. This has been both positive and negative. The partnership has given us the Scottish Enlightenment, has powered the Industrial Revolution, and Scottish science, creativity, and knowledge continue to pack a considerable punch in today's world. However, Scots also took their share of the spoils and exploitations of empire. The country achieved great wealth through the ownership and abuse of slaves, and many prominent Scots oversaw and led the development of the British Empire. This was all achieved through Scotland being part of the economic and political partnership of the United Kingdom. The independence referendum gave Scotland a possibility to do something new, to change its nationhood through the power of the vote. Unlike the options given to the American colonies, it was good to have the chance to do this through a vote. It really was a historic opportunity.
And so, now, in March 2015, do I regret voting yes? Not at all. I still feel passionately that it was right to vote yes. Me and 1.6 million other people. A small number of people did this for narrow, small-minded, petty nationalist reasons. There were xenophobes, English haters, and other general nasties, but no more so than can be found in any group of people. There were similar nasties in the no voting group too. The nasties did not define the attraction of the yes movement for an independent Scotland. The basis of what has come to be known as the 45, that is the 45% who voted yes, that basis was hope and respect, not hatred or fear. It was not about the breakup of the United Kingdom, nor was it about a dislike of English people. To put it simply, when an adult child wants to leave home and set up on their own, it is not because they hate their parents. It is simply that they feel the time is right for them to look after themselves. The yes vote was a gesture of self-confidence, about the desire to make this small part of Europe and this corner of the British Isles a place that can work on its own terms. To my regret, this was not shared by enough people to win the day. We have not been given the chance to show how well an independent Scotland could get on with our brothers and sisters in the rest of Britain. But this is not the end of the story. It is clear that this was a once-in-a-generation opportunity for Scotland. Both David Cameron and Alex Salmond have ruled out the possibility of the referendum being repeated soon. We are not going to see a proliferation of neverendums as politicians keep asking us the same question until we get it right. Even so, the desire for this change will not disappear in Scotland. The settled will, as they call it, of the result was too divided to be clearly one way or another. The thunderingly loud call of 1.6 million people cannot be easily ignored or brushed aside. Scotland will one day be independent, just as other countries such as Canada, Australia, and New Zealand have become independent from the UK. For that to happen, there is clearly a lot more work that needs to be done. It won't happen on its own. Scotland will achieve independence when it feels it is the right time. Obviously, this was not the time. There was too much fear and caution. There was economic fear, which was very understandable after the years of recession and the turbulence of the international markets. And there was caution about the unknown steps that needed to be taken. The other path, the one offered by the No supporters, was also equally unknown. This is the one that has been chosen for now, and it will take us along a route that is very different from where we have been before. But at the time of the vote, it looked more familiar, and so seemed, to the small majority, more safe and secure. When the time is ripe for independence, these opposites will be reversed. Independence will be the attractive and seemingly secure path to take. When that happens, the independence movement will need to offer a future that we feel we know and understand. We will have to learn ways in which that can come about. But an independent Scotland will happen one day. So, thanks for listening to this episode. If you're wanting to explore this any further, then do please check out the show notes on my website. That's mallorynye.com/podcasts. And you might also be interested to explore a new part of the site that I'm developing on Religion Bites, which also includes short podcasts around the themes of Religion Bites. That's it for now, so see you again soon.